From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Die Another Day, the new James Bond film, is opening in theaters. On today's Fresh Air, we feature an interview with composer John Barry, who wrote the Bond theme and 11 007 scores. Also, Sex Mob Does Bond. We hear some improvisations on the Bond themes and talk with the musician and band leader behind them, Steve Bernstein. And film critic David Edelstein has seen all 20 Bond films and reviews the latest one. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Noor Rahm. The government today relaxed the clean air laws that apply to the nation's dirtiest power plants, refineries, and factories. The change is designed to make it easier for those facilities to modernize their plants, but environmentalists object. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
The nation's oldest factories and power plants are exempt from some clean air rules, but if those facilities want to expand, they must clean up their emissions to meet the standards that apply to more modern facilities. The companies complained that the rules created a disincentive for them to change their plants, even if those changes would contribute to cleaner air. The Bush administration has now relaxed those requirements. EPA Administrator Christy Whitman says the new rules will encourage the plants to modernize and become less polluting. But environmental groups say the relaxed standards let the plants pollute more and could lead to dirtier air. Industry representatives say the changes help them but don't go far enough. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
Russian President Vladimir Putin joined with President Bush today in calling on Iraq to comply with the UN resolution that it disarm. Putin said Russia agrees that it is important to be sure Iraq does not possess weapons of mass destruction. NPR's Don Gagne is traveling with the president. He says today's announcement was expected.
It's no surprise that President Putin has backed the UN resolution publicly here after his meeting in St. Petersburg with President Bush. After all, Russia voted for that resolution. But they did apparently reach another understanding that addresses some of the economic concerns Russia has should there be a war in Iraq. Russia has a lot of business ties to Iraq, oil interests there, and could lose potentially billions of dollars in revenue. Iraq also still owes Russia billions of dollars in loans and in debt. So these two men apparently reached an understanding by which the United States acknowledged Russia's economic interests here and has agreed to engage in a dialogue with them on it.
NPR's Don Gagne traveling with the president. Fighting between Muslims and Christians continue today in Nigeria. Officials say at least 100 people have died since Wednesday as the two sides use machetes, axes, guns, and rocks against each other. The trouble began with Muslim objections to the Wiss World pageant being held in Nigeria, saying it promotes indecency and promiscuity. The beauty pageant is still scheduled to be held in Abuja December 9th. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 40 points to 8805 in heavy volume of 1.6 billion shares. The Nasdaq closed up 1 point to 1468, and the S&P 500 closed down 3 points to 930. This is NPR News. Space Shuttle Endeavour is fueled and ready for blastoff tonight in a little more than 2 hours. But bad weather and at two emergency landing sites in Spain may force NASA to postpone the launch for the second time this month. From member station WMFE, Pat Duggins reports.
There have been only two occasions in NASA history when a space shuttle launch was canceled due to bad weather in Europe. Space shuttle astronauts can use one of two landing strips in Spain if they lose engine power before making it to orbit. The launch of Space Shuttle Columbia in 1986 and Atlantis' second Mir docking flight in 1995 both were postponed due to poor conditions across the Atlantic Ocean. This is just the latest concern for a launch that should have taken place almost 2 weeks ago. A leak in an oxygen hose on Endeavour forced NASA to cancel the first liftoff attempt. Then, launch pad technicians damaged the shuttle's robotic arm when they were lowering a work platform into place in Endeavour's open cargo bay. Once the seven-member crew makes it to orbit, they'll dock the shuttle to the International Space Station and install part of the outpost's external frame. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
The 107th Congress adjourned today. As a last act, the House passed and sent to the White House a bill to create a new Department of Homeland Security, the final version already passed by the Senate. It will combine the Customs Service, Coast Guard, and 20 other agencies into one cabinet-level department to fight terrorism. According to the White House, the president will sign the bill into law Monday. The House did not act on any extension for unemployment benefits. Officials estimate that 820,000 people without jobs will run out of assistance December 28th. Another 95,000 people will find themselves in the same situation every week after that. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Universal Pictures, presenting The Emperor's Club, starring Kevin Kline. In every person's life, there's someone who makes all the difference, now in theaters everywhere.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David B. Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Who are you?
Bond. James Bond.
That was Sean Connery, the first James Bond, in a series of movies that began 40 years ago and is still going strong. Pierce Brosnan is the current incarnation of 007, and his latest Bond film, Die Another Day, opens today. From the start, James Bond's image as the ultra-cool spy was enhanced by the theme music that was always playing behind him. Much of the time, the music was as bold and brassy as Bond himself. Composer John Barry wrote the Bond theme, the scores for 11 of the films, and such memorable Bond theme songs as Goldfinger and Thunderball. Barry has scored about 100 films. He won Oscars for his music for The Lion in Winter, Born Free, Out of Africa, and Dances with Wolves. In the Bond films, Barry's classic arrangements mixed rock electric guitar with big brassy horns. It's an interest he developed naturally. Barry studied with Bill Russo, who was Stan Kenton's composer and arranger. Terry spoke with John Barry in 1999.
The James Bond theme is a peculiar mixture of that low rock guitar figure, if you like, and the brass sound of like the Kenton band, and then the bridge that do it up, did up, doody, doodly, da, dee, da. It's almost like a Dizzy Gillespie bebop phrase, you know. So it was this kind of hybrid of all these kind of things that I was involved with at the time. And I must say, I didn't give it too much thought. I didn't have too much time to give it a lot of thought. And it just came out like it did, you know. I didn't sit down and intellectualize about it. And I've never read a James Bond book. I'd only seen like a cartoon strip that they used to have in the Daily Mail in England. So I knew it was about a spy. I knew roughly what the essence was. But I never saw the movie. I just wrote the damn thing, you know.
Well, I love this music, so we have to right now hear the James Bond theme. This is the John Barry Orchestra.
Thank you.
I love it. It's an odd chord at the end, isn't it? That chord that hangs suspended.
Yeah, well,
there.
those laid on fourth, and then that. Yeah. I mean, it's such a concoction. It's like when you start making a soup and you don't know really where you're going, but you make it, and in the end, it kind of tastes okay. You know.
Now straighten me out here.
Yes.
The official composer listed on the credits is Monty
yes,
Norman.
Yes, my God.
So, what's the short version of the story?
I'll answer the question by asking a question.
Yes.
Which is, if I didn't write it, why did they employ me for the next 11 movies?
Right.
No more to be said.
Well, I used to love seeing the openings of the movies, you know, in the Sean Connery days when the series was new. And, you know, the music would start, and then Sean Connery would walk onto the screen and then turn around and pull out his gun as the music swelled behind
right,
him. That was so
right.
exciting. What did you think the first time you saw the music with the whole James Bond, you know, with the whole Sean Connery thing in it?
Well, when I wrote the theme, I was given a timing. I wasn't given any action sequence. I didn't know what they looked like or whatever. So I then... And it was like the movie was in release in 3 weeks' time. It was what we call a wet print when it went into the theatres because it was so behind. And then it opened at the Pavilion in Piccadilly in London, and I went on a Sunday afternoon and saw it, and that was the first time I'd ever seen Dr. No. And they, instead of it, and I understood that I was just writing the main title theme, but then every time he says, I'm Bond, James Bond, and they'd laid it in all over the damn place. And it worked, you know. I mean, there's no with film. There's no middle ground. You know, it either works or it doesn't. You know, there's no. Well, it works a little. I mean, a good score is a score that really works 100%, where you just hit all the buttons.
Now, you not only did the scores for, you know, 11 James Bond films, you wrote the title songs for the films. I want to play one of those title songs. This is Goldfinger, sung by Shirley Bassey. Shirley Bassey singing the theme from Goldfinger, the song and the score written by my guest, John Barry. What were you told that the theme song should convey?
Well, nobody told me anything. Goldfinger was the... After Dr. No, on From Russia With Love, Lionel Bart wrote the song From Russia With Love because he'd...
He's most famous for Fly Me to the Moon and
No, I'm sorry.
The score from Oliver, then.
The score from Oliver.
Yeah, okay.
And Oliver had just opened in... Yeah, you're thinking of...
Bart Howard.
Bart Howard, right. So he had just finished Oliver, and he was, like, riding the top, and rightly so. And I hadn't... Though I'd had an instrumental hits, I hadn't had a song hits. So they said, we want Lionel Bart. So I said, absolutely fine. So I orchestrated all the stuff for the song with Matt Monro, etc., and used a theme throughout the movie. But Goldfinger was the first time they gave me the full shot at the whole damn thing.
Were you told, make this theme sexually insinuating?
No, they really left you alone. They really just... they said, go away and write it. I never discussed with the director or the producers. I discussed it with myself, and I thought, well, what is this about? It's a song about a villain. And then I started to reflect historically. There's no songs about villains. People don't sit down and write songs about villains. They write love songs, they write sad songs, they write torch songs, whatever. But songs about villains are very rare. And then I thought of Kurt Weill's Mack the Knife, which is the definitive song about a villain. So then I got my head on right, and I thought, that's the definitive song. He managed to bring off the most extraordinary song about a villain. And so I sat down and wrote this rather strange melody, just based on the word Goldfinger, as the opening line. And then I thought, well, who can write a lyric to this? So Anthony Newley and Leslie Bricus had also just got a huge theatrical success in England called Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. And I knew Tony very well. I phoned him up and I said, look, I've written this song, I've written the melody, but I haven't got the song. I'd like to meet with you. I went out to his home in Hampstead, played him it. And he said, well, what the hell's it all about? And I said, it's Mack the Knife. It's a song about the villain. And he said, got it. Then I'd worked with Shirley in concerts. I'd done concerts tours with her. And she was very big in England at that time. And Shirley has this one thing. She has such conviction about what she does. So I played her the song, and she said, well, what the hell is this about? It's about a villain, Shirley. I said, don't think too much about it, Shirley. Just go into the studio and convince the world that you know what you're doing. And you can do that, because I've worked with you in the theater, and you do this better than anybody else I know. We then went in and recorded it. And originally, it just started off with the chords, dee-dum, and there was no bar, yeah. That wasn't there then. And we had a break. They went up for their 10-minute tea break. And in the tea break, I just found it that what we were playing, that was empty. So I sat down at the piano, and I came up with a da-ya-na-na-dan, and did it on wow-wow trumpets. And we put that in, which just kind of brought it to life. And then we repeated it down the line. When Harry Saltzman heard it... He was one of the producers. Harry, I can't tell you what he said.
He hated it, huh?
He said, that is the worst mm-mm song I have ever heard in my mm-mm life. But we're stuck with it because we don't have any time and the movie's coming out. And Guy Hamilton, who was the director... He was in the Air Force. He was one of the few who fought the Battle of Britain, and he's very proper and very splendid man. He said, well, I don't know whether it's going to be a hit or not, Harry, but I know dramatically it works for the movie. And Cubby Broccoli said, I like it. Let's do it.
Composer John Barry talking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1999. Barry wrote the scores for 11 James Bond films and about 90 other films, including Midnight Cowboy, Dances with Wolves, and Out of Africa. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with composer John Barry. He wrote the scores for about 100 films, including 11 James Bond movies.
Now you mentioned that Leslie Bricus and Anthony Newley wrote the lyric for Goldfinger. There's actually a terrific Anthony Newley recording that was released a few years ago on...
Go on.
Well, I want to play this in a second. It wasn't released till a few years ago on a kind of reissue compilation.
No, because when we'd done the record, they said... how do we demonstrate it to them? So I went in the studio with Tony and a bass and a bongo. I think that was the full orchestration. And I love Tony's recording, and I'd have loved to have that to have been in the movie. But and that's maybe why they didn't get the drift of it in the initial thing, you know. I love Tony's recording.
I think this version is a little more orchestrated than bass and bongo. And this is a much more kind of sneaky vocal version than the really brassy Shirley.
That's
Bassey
right, exactly.
One. So here's Anthony Newley.
Gold finger, he's the man with the Midas touch. A spider's touch, such a cold finger, beckons you to enter his web of sin, but don't go in. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you fear. For a golden girl knows when he's kissed her, it's the kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger.
Oh, that is really great.
I love Tony. I mean, God, does he know how to point a lyric out? I just love him.
So it's too bad that it wasn't released at the time. I think it could have done well.
I would have thought so.
That wasn't you playing trumpet on there, was it?
No. No, it wasn't. And it was just a guitar and then a little... Do you know what? I think we did it twice. I think that's when we went back in. We did it just first with bongos and bass, and which obviously somebody has that recording somewhere. And I think then we went back in and just made it slightly more substantial.
Did the success of Goldfinger make it obligatory to have... a theme with lyrics for each of the subsequent James Bond films?
Well, why I always demanded writing the music first was that when you see the whole of the movie of Goldfinger, the theme runs throughout the movie, even the whole Fort Knox sequence at the end. The main da-ya-da. I mean, so I don't like a song stuck on the beginning of a movie because it's just a song and then it has nothing to do with the rest of the movie, which is what happens today. All the Bond songs I integrated completely into the score, from You Only Live Twice, Thunderball, Diamonds Forever. They were the main title song, but they were also the genesis of the rest of the score.
There's something about your Goldfinger scores songs that remind me a little bit of the Frankie Lane movie themes, those big Western anthems that he used to sing.
Well, it's kind of, you know, I did one or two interviews with the English press at the time, and they said, well, what is it? And I said, it's Million Dollar Mickey Mouse music. Because it's... and it's Wagnerian. I mean, the whole opening of Goldfinger is like this, it's very pretentious. You know, I mean, it's... But that was the fun of it. You know, and as Fred Astaire said, give it size, give it style, and give it class. And that's like an incredible Bible to follow. And... hopefully that's what we did. We just made everything larger than life, and we made it a lot of fun. So everybody went in. They knew he was going to be, he'd get the broad, he'd kill the villain, he'd be happy. And that was the formula. And we enjoyed it on that level.
Now, we've been focusing on the theme songs, but of course you did, you know, the scores for the whole movies and underscoring for action scenes and scenes where Bond is being, you know, tied up or about to be lasered to death, or there's a snake or a poisonous spider in his bed, or he's about to be executed or whatever. Do you have a favorite scene in how it works with the music that you did for that, where something terrible was about to happen to James Bond?
Oh, God, there's so many. I used to put myself in, like when I used to go to my father's cinema and sit in the front row on a Saturday afternoon and get absolutely thrilled by what was going up there. I tried to put myself into that area. And I guess the in Goldfinger, where he's laid down on the laser thing and the laser's going up between his legs, that's kind of a worrying thought. I guess that was like the epitome of, oh my God, you know. I mean, that was pretty special stuff.
Let's hear the actual scene from the movie.
This is gold, Mr. Bond. All my life I've been in love with its color, its brilliance, its divine heaviness. I welcome any enterprise that will increase my stock, which is considerable.
I think you've made your point, Goldfinger. Thank you for the demonstration.
Choose your next witticism carefully, Mr. Bond. It may be your last. The purpose of our two previous encounters is now very clear to me. I do not intend to be distracted by another. Good night, Mr. Bond.
Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond. I expect you to die. There is nothing you can talk to
me about. A scene from Goldfinger. Composer John Barry is talking with Terry Gross. More of their interview in the second half of the show. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Pretty girl, beware of this heart of gold. This heart is cold. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you feel. Kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl, beware of this heart of gold. This heart is cold. He loves only gold. Only gold. He
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, committed to serving Lutherans, their families, and communities with financial strategies and customer-focused service. Online at thrivent.com. By Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of I, Richard by Elizabeth George, author of A Traitor to Memory. And by Universal Pictures, presenting The Emperor's Club, starring Kevin Kline. In every person's life, there is someone who makes all the difference. Now in theaters everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Tom Jones does Thunderball. We continue our conversation with composer John Barry. And we hear some fun improvisations on the Bond themes and talk with musician Steve Bernstein of the Sex Mob. Also, David Edelstein reviews Die Another Day. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. We continue now with more of Terry's conversation from 1999 with composer John Barry. Barry wrote the original theme to James Bond, the brassy, sassy music that's as much a part of the character as a shaken martini and a tightly tailored tuxedo. Barry also wrote Goldfinger, still one of the most memorable title songs in movie history, and has won several Oscars for his scores for other films.
There's one more James Bond song that I have to get in here, and that's Thunderball, the theme from Thunderball, sung by Tom Jones. I think this is just a particularly fun one also.
Well, there's a kind of fascinating story behind that, because that is probably the worst title for a song you can imagine.
Oh, exactly.
I mean, you know, and I spoke to Tony Newley about it, actually, and he says, what do we do? Thunderball, marvelous, you should care for me. Thunderball. So I said, that's not going to work. I think somebody already did that. So it was such an abstract title. So they were shooting down in Nassau. Not Nassau County, you know, the island. They were doing all that stuff down there. And I flew down there, and on the way down, I was reading a magazine, and it said that the Italians had a name for James Bond now, which was Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which I thought was really terrific. So I thought, instead of using the word Thunderball, why don't we write a song called Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang? Cubby absolutely loved it. Harry loved it. Everybody fell in love with it. So I recorded. I recorded with Dionne Warwick. We recorded with Shirley. And then the powers that be at United Artists in New York, literally 2 weeks before the movie opened, phoned him and said, you know, we need that Goldfinger thing. We need that title over the radio, and Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang isn't doing it. We need Thunderball. So I called up Don Black and I said, look, I got this. We got to do this in like no time whatsoever. So I said, what does it mean? And he said, I don't know what the hell it means. I really don't know what it means. So I wrote a theme that facilitated the word. Don then wrote the lyric. He then called Tom Jones. And now the whole Bond thing was being a big success. You know, you could have called anybody. You know, everybody now wanted to do Bond songs because of the success that Shirley had had and the whole aura that was hanging around the movies. So Tom came in, and he said the first thing when he heard it, he said, what the hell's it about? In his Welsh accent, what the hell's it about? I said, Tom, don't ask. Just take a leaf out of Shirley's book, get in the studio, sing the hell out of it, and leave. Please, don't get into it. Just do that. And he said, oh, all right, okay, I'll do it. So he goes, and it was the same. It was the same mood. Just convince everybody. And he was so convincing. I don't think anybody really analyzed what the hell he was singing about. And I still don't know what the song is about to this day. But we were given that problem, and we have to live with it.
Well, the lyricist came up with good ideas for Thunderball. They call him the winner who takes all, and he
yes,
strikes
Don
like
did.
Thunderball.
Absolutely.
A decent solution
yeah, he
to
did.
The problem.
He did actually, in the nick of time, come out with that line, which made it slightly credible, you know.
I love his lyrics. They're so funny. His days of asking are all gone. His fight goes on and on and on.
Right, right.
So you must have had fun doing this. I mean, this is just really, it's very silly and very fun.
Talk about a license to kill. It's a license right. to write silly and just have great fun. You know, I mean, that was the whole joy of these movies, that this was not Citizen Kane, you know. It was just this fun comic strip, so you could get away with murder.
Well, it's time to hear Thunderball, sung by Tom Jones, music by my guest John Barry.
She always runs while others walk. He acts while other men just talk. He looks at this world and wants it all.
so he strikes like thunderbolt. He knows the meaning of success. His needs are more, so he gives less. And he strikes like thunderbolt.
Talk about big arrangements. That is really great. I like the way you managed to work in the James Bond theme underneath it. Oh, very nice.
Every trick in the book we use, believe me, we didn't leave anything out. Actually, you didn't play the best part of the song, actually. The bridge, da da dee da 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 dum da da dee da da da. The bridge actually makes that song work.
Okay, cue it up to the bridge. Bob Purdock, our engineer, please cue it up to the bridge.
Bridge is the most important part of any song. Gershwin said, is the bridge. It's the release. It's how you get from, and it's the old 1930s pattern of 32 bar songs, eight bars, bridge and end, and it's so important how you get that release.
Any woman he wants, he'll get. He will break any heart without regret. His days of asking.
No, I interrupted your thought about the bridge.
You know, it sets up getting back. It goes into another area, but it also sets up getting back into the main theme, which is it's not as simple as it sounds.
Composer John Barry from a 1999 interview with Terry Gross. Coming up, improvising on the 007 themes. This is Fresh Air. With Die Another Day opening today in theaters, and James Bond celebrating his 40th year as a movie icon, we're moving from an interview with someone who wrote much of the Bond music to an interview with someone who enjoys it. Steve Bernstein, a film composer and leader of the band Sex Mob, loves the Bond music so much that he and his band recorded an entire tribute CD called Sex Mob Does Bond. The first cut on the CD, inspired by music from the film series, is a typically eccentric number called Dr. Yes. That's Dr. Yes, composed by trumpet player Steven Bernstein, leader of the band Sex Mob. Bernstein is a longtime member and musical director of John Lurie's Lounge Lizards. He orchestrated, arranged, and conducted such film scores as Get Shorty, Kansas City, and Clay Pigeons. A review in Spin magazine said, "Sex Mob is all the fun that jazz, and lately rock, has forgotten to have." Terry spoke with Bernstein last year.
I love the James Bond music. So
I do too.
It's got like big drama in it and these like sexy tango rhythms and stuff. What gets you about the music?
Well, it's all of that. It's exotic. You know, it's great when music can take you to another place. And I think one of the greatest things is that you can actually listen to these records and kind of imagine a James Bond, just that whole larger concept of Bond. And you listen to these records, and John Barry's scores are just, they're melodically really strong, but there's also John Barry's a very interesting musician. He was one of the first musicians, he was a trumpet player, and he was one of the early composers that could successfully mix jazz music, classical music, and what was the beginning at that time of rock and roll or pop music. He had a combo that had two guitars in it, but they read music as opposed to... usually when you hear electric guitars in music, they're improvising, they're playing rhythm parts, and his music always had written electric guitar parts, which is a very specific sound of a certain era, which I happen to love. And, you know, whenever you hear that doom 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 really low in the guitar register, that's a real John Barry trademark.
Which Bond movies have you gone to where the music was most noticeable? Or do you love the music more from sitting home listening to your recordings from the soundtracks?
That is actually, I got to say, that's how I've learned to love the music most. Because it's interesting, I just watched Goldfinger with my son, and a lot of this music is from Goldfinger. And it's interesting how much of it gets ducked. See, when you score a film, they end up ducking a lot of the music, either for dialogue or for explosions and car crashes.
By ducking, you mean fading it out or covering it up?
Yeah, right. They have to bring the music down and then bring up the special effects at the end. So that's the last part of making a film, is they bring it all together on a soundstage, and they take the music and they bring it up and down according to like what else is happening. So if there's dialogue, they bring the music down. And again, especially in action films, there's a lot of car crashes, a lot of explosions, helicopter sounds, train sounds. All those things make the music come down. But when you actually listen to, you know, I have these score records on vinyl. You actually get to hear the entire piece, and you realize they're really beautiful pieces of music, too.
Each of the tracks have titles that relate to the part of the plot that the music is being played in. So I thought we'd play a track that's called Odd Jobs Pressing Engagement.
Can I just tell you, I just found out what that was because I just saw Goldfinger.
Yeah.
That's the scene where they've killed a guy and they've put him in the back of a car, and then the car gets compacted in one of those huge compactors.
Oh, pressing engagement.
Pressing,
I get it.
Engagement. Yeah.
Okay. So obviously this is from Goldfinger, and you hear the Goldfinger theme and the 007 theme weaving in and out of it. Tell me why you chose this track to do on your CD.
Every track I chose because I felt the melodies stood strong enough to be played in an individual manner. The pieces I felt could withstand what I call the sex mob treatment, which is that these melodies are going to be played literally, but they're also going to be stretched to their limits, and, you know, they'll be able to hold on and, you know, withstand the treatment.
Okay, well, let's hear the treatment of Odd Jobs Pressing Engagement from the James Bond film Goldfinger, and this is music from the CD Sex Mob Does Bond.
Music from the CD Sex Mob Does Bond, and my guest, Stephen Bernstein, is the founder of Sex Mob. Stephen, talk a little bit more about the Sex Mob treatment when you choose a song to do.
Well, Sex Mob, and we've been together about 6 years, and now many people know us as a cover band, because when you come to hear Sex Mob, you probably hear songs by ABBA, James Brown, Prince, The Grateful Dead, Duke Ellington, The Rolling Stones, et cetera, what I call the 20th century songbook. It didn't start this way. It started off as like most bands in New York, you know, some extension of a person's ego when you have your music and your idea of what you want to do. And unlike most bands, we never rehearsed. We only played gigs. We started off having a weekly gig. And what I would do is I would show up kind of with a chart every week, or a couple charts, and we just play them live. We were playing at the Knitting Factory Tap Bar very late at night, from 11 to 2 in the morning every Thursday. And I had just started listening to Bond vinyl. I mean, it's kind of all goes, it's a circular thing here. And I had made a chart of this song called Bond with Bongos. And we started playing it, and it starts off with a long vamp. I originally used it because I thought it would be a good vehicle for a drum solo at the end of the piece. And we start off with a kind of introduction and let the bass play a little bit. And we hit the James Bond theme, and suddenly this whole bar just erupts in like screaming and applause and this kind of general feeling of happiness. And I went, wow, this is great. I mean, here we are playing this totally unconventional style of music, and everyone just reacted in this great way. And I realized that if you play themes that people know, it doesn't matter how you play them, because they can connect with them, even if you're like approaching them from a very, you know, unorthodox approach to playing music. And so I started searching for themes that were really strong and we could play in any way we wanted, because we tend to play songs different every time we play, that people would still recognize.
You know, you had mentioned that at the Knitting Factory Bar, when you were playing the James Bond theme, that people went nuts.
Yeah.
Now you do that on the new CD, in the track that you were mentioning, the Bond with Bongos.
Right.
And it's almost like a can-can version of the Bond theme. let me just play that.
Okay.
Why did you do the Bond theme in that manner?
I wish I could tell you there's an answer for this stuff, but it's just the way it happened.
You're very intuitive, obviously.
Yeah, the thing is, this is a working band. This band has worked for 6 years. This music is unrehearsed. I mean, it's all written. These are all charts, but I don't believe in rehearsing things. Well, I can't afford to, and it's allowed me to create a philosophy of not believing in rehearsing. And the beauty of that is what you get when you listen to one of my CDs is you get the first take of something. And I kind of feel there's so many CDs that come out now that it's, you want to have something special on your CD. And I think one of the great things to try to capture on tape is a feeling of something actually happening, which is that is musicians reacting to each other for the first time. Now, musicians tend to be very smart people. And obviously, if we're making CDs, we've been doing what we've been doing for a long time. So once you rehearse something once, then the musician starts thinking with the other side of their brain. They go like, you know what, when we get to this part, I'm going to do this. They're already thinking ahead. But if you get that first take where they're not even sure what the other musicians are playing, and they're constantly reacting, and maybe even making tiny mistakes, and then creating something new out of that, that's what you get on these CDs. And so, like I said, I can't really tell you why I chose that rhythm, but or why we did it that way. But basically, I probably just said, listen, we're going to start with a bass solo. You know, we're going to hit this theme, and we're going to end with a drum solo. And let's hit it and count it off. And that's what happened.
Composer Steve Bernstein of the Sex Mob recorded last year. Their CD is Sex Mob Does Bond. Sex Mob plays this weekend at Sweet Rhythm in New York City. So how does the new James Bond film measure up? Coming up, a review of Die Another Day. This is Fresh Air. Just in case you think we haven't bonded enough on today's show, here's a little more. Film critic David Edelstein has seen all 20 Bond films and has a review of the newest one, Die Another Day, with Pierce Brosnan in his fourth turn as 007 and Halle Berry as the first Oscar-winning Bond girl.
I've never been able to resist the James Bond pictures, not even the really lame ones, when Roger Moore got so thick that the switch to a wiry stuntman in mid-chase made you choke on your popcorn. When 007, whoever he's played by, strolls in his tuxedo into the roving bullet sight and crouches and fires into the camera and the blood runs down the screen, I'm like a Pavlov dog. I'm drooling at that mixture of brutality and old-world English elegance. So Die Another Day. Well, it's three-quarters of a very lively movie, even if you don't grade on my Pavlovian curve. It's directed by the New Zealander Lee Tamahori, who made a devastating portrait of working-class Maori spousal abuse called Once Were Warriors. And it has a dash more realism than usual. And you don't want in a Bond picture more than a dash. You're supposed to be in and out of them, laughing at their flagrant mega-budget excesses. You know this Bond picture will be different, though, from its title sequence, which leaves you shaken, not stirred. It's not the usual leggy silhouettes straddling long gun barrels. It's a torture montage. After Bond has been captured by the North Koreans, our friends from the Axis of Evil, the wriggling silhouettes are of women, but also of scorpions, and Madonna's voice on the disco-y title track has been made to sound robotic, so for a change, she's expressively inexpressive, with an eerie lack of pity. When Judi Dench's M shows up after Bond's 18-month imprisonment, she doesn't exactly shower him with kisses. She seems a bit irritated he survived.
Gene therapy. New identities courtesy of DNA transplants.
So-called beauty parlor. We'd heard rumors of such a place. I didn't think it really existed.
It doesn't anymore. Zhao got away. But he left these behind. All from Gustav Graves' mine. I think it's a front for laundering African conflict diamonds.
We need to tread carefully. Graves is politically connected.
Lucky I'm on the outside, then.
Well, it seems you've become useful again.
Then maybe it's time you let me get on with my job.
Pretty cold, that exchange. And that coldness gives the movie some unexpected bite. It only goes wrong in the last half hour with some campy FX and a noisy car chase through a giant ice palace and the great secondary villain, played by Rick Yoon with a face embedded with diamonds, doesn't get the grand comeuppance he deserves. But even if the end flatlines a bit, Die Another Day is still a resurrection, the best Bond movie since The Spy Who Loved Me. Pierce Brosnan is really growing on me. No, he's not Sean Connery. But it was only Connery's singular combination of working-class ruggedness and snobbery that made us think 007 a more interesting character than he is. Brosnan brings the right steely sense of entitlement to Bond. He makes you believe that Bond's absurd feats are the plausible upshot of his refusal to be bested by a social or sexual inferior. The actor is still sleek, but the touch of crepe paper around his face has eliminated the department store mannequin look that the TV show Remington Steele exploited so shrewdly. He's vulnerable now. And so are we. Bond comes out of torture into what M says is a changed world. He missed 9/11. And the snooty supervillain, played by Toby Stevens, has some Noam Chomsky-esque lines about having studied Western hypocrisy at Oxford and Harvard. He makes fun of the British for believing they still have the right to police the world, and we can't let him get away with that, can we? Amid all this white male sense of entitlement is the first major African-American Bond girl, Jinx, played by Halle Berry, whose Ursula Andress entrance out of the surf caused the preview audience to erupt in cheers. This is not Bond's first interracial romance, and I don't think you can call the movie progressive, since the big climax is two gorgeous women in very tight tank tops having at each other with swords and martial arts. And I don't even think Halle Berry is compelling as an actress here. She's something to see, but her voice is dead. But she has her Oscar now, and the studio is talking about a Jinx spinoff. And it's hard to imagine we'll ever be quite as complacent again with a Bond girl who doesn't get to kill a lot of people, too.
David Edelstein is film critic for online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Ian Chillog. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Bean Cooley, David Bean Cooley.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Universal Pictures, presenting The Emperor's Club, starring Kevin Kline. In every person's life, there is someone who makes all the difference, now in theaters everywhere. From Harcourt, publisher of Life of Pi by Yann Martell, a modern-day adventure story. And by Nonsuch Records and Travelogue, the new album by Joni Mitchell, a 2-CD set featuring new recordings of 22 songs spanning her entire career, accompanied by full orchestra. Available at Barnes & Noble. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how I lost 5 pounds in 6 years. We talk with Tom Arnold about his new memoir, his weight, his marriage with Roseanne Barr, and his work on the Fox Sports Show. Join us for the next Fresh Air.